Thank you, Dasani. So, yes, the title of my talk is The Bodhisattva's Reply, and that's the title of this event, of course. And as we've heard, it's also, well, it's the title of a poem by Sangharakshita. And he wrote the poem when he was living in India. And, I guess, reading the poem, that he wrote it after witnessing, well, real scenes of poverty and degradation, the kind of things that Sally just described herself seeing when she was in India. And so there's a number of verses, and then there's this refrain that repeats through the poem. What will you say to them? What will you say to them? This refrain comes again and again. So, for example, he sees dim, shadowy figures from the outcast village flit, balancing on their heads baskets to bear away garbage and excrement, hugging the wall for fear of the scorn of their fellow men. What will you say to them? So you sense that the poem comes out of, a kind of intense questioning. He's troubled, he's disturbed. He sees these things and it really makes him wonder, what can Buddhism say about this? What should he be doing as a Buddhist? So in this talk I'm going to try and explore what is the Bodhisattva's reply, and particularly what can we do as a spiritual community to reply, to respond to the suffering in the world. So surely you might think the answer is simple. If we just give, we just respond, we just kind of get out there, we just act with compassion. But I suppose it's not as simple as that, or it's not always as simple as that. Sometimes we feel we know what we should do, we know what we want to do, but we feel resistance, we feel fear, we feel limitation. We come up against our self-preoccupation, our self-clinging. So maybe, for example, there's a call on our generosity, but we just feel resistance and tightness. We feel we can't let go of what we've got. Or we know that there's someone that needs our sympathy, but they also irritate us, and we just find it hard to kind of reach out towards them. Or we're in a situation where we know that we should speak the truth, we need to speak out, but we just feel our confidence draining away. We sense a sense of insecurity, a sense of not wanting to be unpopular. So in all these kinds of situations, we're just wanting to stay within the self, safe bounds of self. There's a fixed and boundaried and limited sense of me that doesn't want to be threatened. So compassion, being actively concerned for the world and reaching out to the world, requires that we overcome this self-preoccupation, this self-clinging. That we have a different sense of self that's less fearful, less self-preoccupied, in a way that's bigger, more expansive. So that's why teachings around the self and the nature of the self are so central in Buddhism. The Buddha saw that attachment to self is the kind of fundamental problem about being a human being. It's what stops us reaching out, connecting with other people, helping each other. So as you know, the Buddha had this teaching of anatman. It's one of the most central and distinctive teachings of the Buddha. And anatman means something like no self or no fixed self. So what the Buddha was saying is that we tend to assume subconsciously that there's a me, there's a self, somehow kind of inside here or somehow behind my experience looking out at the world. And often that's how our mind does structure our experience. There's a very strong sense of me in here and you out there. I'm experiencing that right now quite strongly. But what the Buddha said was, although we might experience things like that, actually, if you look really closely at your experience, there isn't a self behind the experience. There's just the flow of experience. There's no self kind of separate and aloof from experience. There's just the flow of experience. But surely we have an experience of ourselves. Surely the Buddha is saying that's not kind of deluded and unreal. I think what the Buddha was saying is that experience of self, that sense of ourself, that sense of me, arises out of conditions. It's another part of that flow of experience. Our sense of self is always being created, always being produced, always being conditioned by our thoughts and our actions. So then the Buddha went on to explore how different thoughts and actions tend to create a different experience of self. So some thoughts and actions tend to create an experience of self that is rather small and hard and inflexible and cut off from the world. So, for example, if I'm irritable, I tend to tense up in my body. I feel hard and restricted in my heart. My thoughts have a certain heat, and they circle round a kind of self-enclosed little circle. So what all those experiences tend to do is they make that sense of self feel or seem even more real. The irritability arises out of a sense of threatened self that's not getting what it wants, but it then tends to lead to experiences that reinforce that sense of self. So it's kind of self-perpetuating. And what the Buddha was saying is, well, those experiences that you have are real, but the idea of the self behind them, that's unhelpful. That's not really how things are. But luckily, other kinds of thought, other kinds of action, such as love, such as courage, such as generosity, they arise out of a different sense of ourself and who we are, and then they tend to condition and create an even more different sense of self, more expansive, more flexible, more permeable, not so fixed and limited. So if you forgive someone that you've been resenting, or if you apologise for something that you've done wrong, again, you feel it change you. You feel it change your sense of self. Your body relaxes. Your heart softens and opens. Your mind feels a sense of relief and lightness. So in other words, those kind of actions lead to experiences which make our sense of ourselves lighter, more free, less separate, more connected. They gradually refine and transform and ultimately transcend that sense of self. So in a way, that's what the Buddha's teaching of Anatman was trying to get at. How we're creating a sense of self at every moment. Everything we think, everything we do is creating and conditioning a sense of self. All the ways that we respond to the world around us are doing that. We're always making choices. We're always in a process of becoming. Always, in a sense, choosing ourself. And then, of course, what happens is the way we do this, as I've mentioned, tends to become self-perpetuating. So we're in a certain state of mind, and then out of that state of mind we think and we act in a certain kind of way, and then that conditions how we tend to perceive the world, how we tend to interpret what's going on around us. It becomes conditioned by that underlying mind state. So if I'm in a bit of a miserable state, and I see someone walking across the field and I wave to them and I ignore them, I kind of interpret it as they're ignoring me, maybe. Yeah. Actually, they just haven't noticed me. They've got their head down, they're trying to fix their tent that's leaking or something like that. But I interpret it in a certain way. Then maybe I'm a bit brusque with them when I see them, and so then they do avoid us. Yeah. I actually kind of create the situation that I was imagining through that kind of fragile, held in sense of self. So this again is going on all the time in different ways, positive and negative. Our minds create a world which can tend to reinforce and perpetuate the mind state that created it in the first place. So we create our own little subjective worlds. And then you get lots of people doing that together and they create a collective world. So to try and illustrate this, I want to tell you a little story that I witnessed a year or so ago. I actually told this story on the urban retreat last year, but it illustrates my point rather well, so I'm going to tell it again. And basically, I was in Worcester, where I live. I was meeting someone for a coffee, and I was just waiting in the street. And down the road, I saw a woman walking up the street. And I could tell straight away from her body and her posture and the way she was sort of stomping up the road that she was in quite an angry and disturbed state. And because she was in this state, she wasn't really looking where she was going. She was just in her own little world. And so she walked past a mother with a young child, and she just brushed rather roughly against the child. I don't think she hurt the child, but it was a bit, you know, she just didn't really notice what she was doing. And then the mother, who was in her kind of little world, rather than being able to take in what had happened and just get the child out the way, she turned round and she immediately snapped at the angry woman. And then the angry woman, rather than seeing what she'd done and just saying, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean it," and stepping to one side, squared up to the mother. And they started shouting at each other and accusing each other and arguing. And then a man who was in another little group nearby, he started walking up to the situation and swearing at the angry woman. So it was like a realm of the Wheel of Life appearing in front of my eyes. I could just see these people in a certain state of self creating this world, and everything that happened then sort of reinforced and seemed to justify the kind of state that they were in. And it was kind of getting more and more ugly and unhappy. And I was wondering what to do, wondering how to intervene, not sure what to say or do. But I was just starting to kind of walk over to try and diffuse the situation in some way when a young woman walked up the street. She was just walking up the street. She didn't even really change her route. She just carried on walking. She passed the angry woman and she linked her arm in the arm of the angry woman and she looked her right in the eyes and she said, "Come on, love, you don't need to worry about all that." And she just walked her off around the corner. So I thought, well, that's the Bodhisattva's reply. I was actually really inspired and moved by that instant. She just dealt with it so skillfully. And you could just see that she was just in a much more aware and responsive state of mind. And she didn't have that kind of hard-edged sense of self that needed to maintain itself by accusing and counter-accusing. She just had a much more open, broad sense of herself that could take those people in, sum up the situation quite quickly, and just naturally and spontaneously know how to respond. She was able to break up that ugly little situation, help break down the walls of that mind-made prison that those people were creating for themselves. So that's the Bodhisattva's reply. We practice the Dharma in order to gradually refine and transform and eventually transcend that sense of self, so that we can see the world differently and so that we're able to influence the world, create a different kind of world around us. And all Dharma practice is about transforming the sense of self in that way. So for example, the mindfulness of breathing practice that we probably all do, we watch the breath, we maybe notice distractions and fantasies and worries arising in our mind, we just try to let them go and come back to the experience of the breath. So in a way, what we're doing in that practice is we're kind of reconditioning the self. We're working with to transform the self in that kind of way. Because those distractions and worries tend to be rather self-preoccupied. They tend to kind of circle round in a rather narrow, restricted kind of way. And we're just trying to let those go and come back to our real present experience. And if we do that, if we manage to engage with that practice, gradually, our sense of self changes. We feel more grounded. Our mind becomes more clear. We feel our awareness sort of deepen. And we've got a more broad perspective. So we maybe get up from the meditation, at least to some extent, having recreated, reconditioned that sense of self. Able to be more objective. Able to have a more spacious, considered response to whatever it is we encounter in the world. And all Dharma practices are like that. All the Dharma practices that we do, metta, ritual, study, reflection, insight, they're all about transforming the self in this way. Stepping out of fixed, limited self, stepping out of the self-attachment that keeps us in our own little worlds, unable to respond to others. We're transforming ourself, and that means we start to transform the world around us. So my next question is, well, what's this got to do with the big problems in the world that we know about? So it's all very well, you know, a little group of people having an argument on the streets of Worcester, but what about the kind of major problems that our world is facing? And obviously there are some things that go in the world which arise out of much more complicated conditions. They're much bigger problems and they involve many, many more people. And obviously that means they're harder to change, they're harder to influence in that kind of way. But I suppose my point is that they still arise out of the same dynamic. They still arise out of the same process or the same relationship of self and world. They still arise out of human beings being in a certain mind state that creates a certain kind of world. So we could take the caste system in India as an example. It's one that we know a bit about in Sri Ratna because of the work that we do in India, because our movement is so active in India. So Dr. Ambedkar, the great leader of the oppressed castes, in a way what he realised was this dynamic between self and world. What he saw was that caste wasn't just social and political structures, it was also a state of mind. Caste was in people's minds. It was in the minds of the oppressed and in the minds of the oppressor. And then people in those state of minds, with those sort of mindsets and attitudes, then created and perpetuated certain social and political structures. Those structures then reinforced and perpetuated the attitudes and the beliefs, the state of mind that underlay caste. And eventually Dr. Ambedkar realised that although changing the political structures could help, it didn't go deep enough. If you didn't change the underlying state of mind, the structures, the whole culture would just reassert itself, would just recreate itself in a new way. You had to get down deeper. You had to change the attitudes. You had to change the mindset. So that's why he converted to Buddhism, as a way of doing this and as a way of helping his followers to be able to change their minds in that kind of way and so change the world around them. Here's a quote from Dr. Ambedkar. "History bears out the proposition that political revolutions have always been preceded by social and religious revolutions. The emancipation of the mind and the soul is a necessary preliminary for the political expansion of a people." So there's lots of evidence, there's a growing body of evidence amongst those communities who converted in India, and evidence that they have done better educationally, socially, economically, because their attitudes changed, because they saw themselves and felt about themselves differently. They were able to kind of go into the world in a different kind of way and change the world around them. Another example could be the whole culture of consumerism, a bit closer to home. So it's a strong feature of our culture. And obviously it's much less pernicious than something like caste. It's much less obviously harmful. In a way, a lot of what's on offer in consumerism may not be that bad in itself. There's even a kind of abundance and creativity about it, which is quite impressive in a certain kind of way. On the other hand, we also know that a lot of the cheap consumer goods that are on offer depend on cheap labour in poor countries. And we also know that more and more consumption means a greater environmental impact. The trouble is that we often don't see that. We forget it. It's so far away. It's going on so far away. It's out of sight and therefore out of mind. But if we saw, for example, how our smartphones and our computers are made and manufactured, if we saw the mines from which they get the tin that makes the circuit boards, we might be quite horrified by what's going on. We also know that consumerism doesn't make the people that consume happy. Again, there's a whole growing body of research into this in Western societies and how living standards go up and up over time, and yet people don't get more and more happy. Once people have reached a certain standard of living, happiness levels seem to stay about the same, maybe even get a bit less. But what's interesting is as living standards go up and up, people's perception of what they need, what level of income they need to be happy, just goes up and up beyond it. Yeah, because people are comparing themselves with others who've got more than them. So this is a real feature of Western societies, that we have more and more but we just think we need even more and we're less happy. So consumerism is a delusion. It's an unconscious belief that happiness comes from owning things, or it comes from the status that you get through acquiring expensive or fashionable possessions. And that delusion also arises out of a sense of self. It's a sense of, well, if I can have things and get things, they become kind of appendages to me and my personality. They're sort of extensions of myself in a certain kind of way. And yes, again, you can see that relationship between self and world. Out of that sense of self arises a whole incredibly complex and sophisticated world of advertising, of fashion, production, distribution, retailing and consuming. And then that world reinforces and perpetuates the sense of self. Well, that world reinforces and conditions the kind of self that created that world in the first place. So again, consumerism is in the mind. Can only really be changed by us changing our minds and by us realising what really creates happiness and meaning. So yes, I'm exploring this relationship between self and world. And then the next question is, okay, if we've got these huge problems that might arise out of that relationship, but they're so big and complex, how can we make any difference to them? How can we have any effect on them? These worlds that I've been describing are big and complicated, and they're created out of a collective of many minds, as it were. Many minds would need to change to really change those worlds. So where does that leave us? What can we do? How can we create a better world? What do we do as Buddhists? What do we do as a spiritual community? So I want to explore three very broad possibilities, three ways that spiritual communities have tried to create a better world in the past. So one way that spiritual communities have related to the world and tried to, is by trying to create an escape from the world, refusing to engage with the world and just withdrawing from it, retreating from it. So you see that the world is deluded and crazy to some extent. You see it's full of suffering. And so you just try and separate off and create something better. So this is sometimes what spiritual communities have done. So I think, for example, of the Amish community in America, just really separating off from the world and trying to create something better in an isolated way. And maybe that does allow some people to live a more human life. But there's a problem. And Sangharakshita discusses this problem in a lecture he gave many years ago. It's called A Vision of History. And he says that spiritual communities, by definition, cannot be self-perpetuating. Yeah. By definition, a spiritual community cannot be self-perpetuating. And what he meant by that was that you can't just be cut off from the world and have children, and then those children will stay as members of your spiritual community. Yeah? Some of them might want to be, but some might want to go and do other things. Yeah? Or you might try and make them stay, but as soon as you start doing that, it stops being a spiritual community because they're not really there out of their own free will, as it were. So he says this is the great weakness and the great strength of a spiritual community. It can't just kind of carry on by itself. It has to reach out into the world. It always has to be drawing more people into it in order to stay viable, in order to stay spiritually alive. And if that doesn't happen, if a community becomes isolated, it's very likely it will struggle to do that and it will disappear. And that is what tends to happen. So that's possibility number one, creating an escape from the world, but it has that danger, that weakness to it. So the second possibility is that you go into the world, you try and change it. You just fully immerse yourself in the world and take on the kind of injustices and things that you see going on. Again, you can see that to some extent the world is deluded and crazy and suffering, and you just want to create something better. And again, spiritual communities have sometimes worked in this way. Sometimes they have been at the forefront of important social change. For example, maybe prison reform or ways that people with mental health problems have been treated by society, or the abolition of slavery. Quite often in those movements, it's been people from faith communities who've taken a strong part in them. And sometimes they have brought about important change. But there's a danger, there's a problem of a spiritual community working in this kind of way. The danger is that you become so immersed in the world that the spiritual values are lost or diluted, and they eventually die out. And again, you do see this happen in history. You see many communities going out into the world in this way, but eventually they lose their spiritual roots and they just become ordinary and worldly in time. So I lived for many years in Birmingham, a city up the road, and Birmingham's got an interesting history. It's a big city, but it's actually not a very old city at all. In the 18th century, it was just a small Midlands town. And what happened through the 18th and 19th century was lots of people moved there, very often from non-conformist Christian sects, non-conformist Christian churches. And the reason they moved there was that at that time in Britain, there was a law against these people being able to set up their own churches within a certain distance of the Anglican cathedrals. They just weren't allowed to do that, so they had to move away from the cathedrals in order to be able to establish themselves. So Birmingham was one of the places they went. A lot of Unitarians, also Quakers, but also other non-conformist churches. And one of the things they did in Birmingham was they created villages for the workers that lived in the factories. So if you went to the south of Birmingham, places like Bourneville, you'll still see these areas with actually very nice small housing, nice gardens, nice little kind of village greens, and no pubs, because they didn't want to encourage drinking. So they created these little villages, and they also set up businesses and companies that were run on ethical lines. So they really tried to do something, really tried to kind of create a good city, as it were. But the thing is, if you went to Birmingham today, you would never know that. You would never guess that that was the origins of those places and those companies. The companies have largely just become just ordinary companies like anything else. Yeah. So they went into the world, but gradually what happened was it got absorbed and assimilated into the world. And yes, if you went there today, you wouldn't feel any spiritual influence in those places, in the way that there was at the start, as it were. So I actually wonder, under this area, whether the whole phenomenon of mindfulness is kind of interesting in this way. So as you know, mindfulness is becoming more and more of a big thing in our culture, and there's more and more ways in which mindfulness is being used to help people. And, well, obviously, if it can help people with mental health problems, with chronic pain and so on, that's a really good thing. It's a really positive thing. But I also wonder whether the danger is this same thing, this danger of assimilation. You can kind of see what happens. It starts off being taught by people who've come from the Buddhist tradition. They're kind of rooted in a spiritual community. But more and more people learn it who aren't from those communities. It just becomes a kind of technique. And gradually it gets distorted. It gets diluted. So you hear, for example, that military personnel these days are sometimes taught mindfulness. You hear about business leaders learning mindfulness so they can make difficult business decisions with more equanimity. And you think, is that really what the Buddha taught? So you see what I mean? There's a danger. There's a way that mindfulness might get out in the culture which is really helpful and beneficial to people, but there's also a danger that can just be absorbed and assimilated and subtly distorted in a worldly kind of way, so that it just ends up supporting and justifying worldly values. So that's the second way a spiritual community might work. Going out into the world, you might be able to do good things, but there's this danger of distortion and absorption, as it were. The third possibility is to create a spiritual community which is out there in the world, but you're creating a place, a context, where people can learn about the spiritual path, practice the spiritual path together, live together, play together, But you're also, you're in interaction with the world. You're out there in the world. You're trying to draw more people in. You're trying to be a beacon for those values, for that spiritual path in the world. So it's a kind of halfway house between the other two possibilities. You're not pulling right away from the world, but nor are you going right into the world. You're kind of sitting in between and offering something that's very distinctive and particular. And you're doing that in a way that you really are trying to attract people and help people and respond to people in that kind of way. So, of course, you can see this has probably been the main emphasis or the main approach of our community so far. We've created Buddhist centres, we've created communities, we've created Right Livelihood projects. All these things are about trying to create places and contexts where people can really live a Dharma life. But it does it in a way which makes it visible and available to the surrounding society. It has a kind of effect on the surrounding society. I don't think that's the only way we've worked. So, for example, Karuna Trust, they just go out into the world and they respond to the suffering in the world in the second kind of way that I was describing. But probably this third one, this creation of spiritual community, has so far been Tri Ratna's main emphasis. And I'd argue that it needs to be. When you're starting something off, you have to start there. You have to start by creating a core of people who are really in contact with the Dharma, who are really kind of working on themselves and trying to overcome fixed, limited self-preoccupation, self-clinging, as it were. That's where you have to start, by creating that committed core. In a way, that always has to be the most important thing, because it's needed for the spiritual community to keep alive and vibrant and keep existing into the future. So does that mean that's the only option? Does that mean that's the only way we can work, the only way the Sangha can interact with the world? So no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that I think it's the most important one and the central one and the one that needs to come first and foremost, as it were. But it's not the only way we can work. I think you can have people who remove themselves from the world, and I think you can have people who really go out into the world, and that can be really helpful and beneficial and a good way to practice and a good way to influence the world, as it were. But I'd say those other two depend on this third one being really vibrant and healthy. It has to be that way round. So yes, you can work in all these ways as long as you've got that core spiritual community existing as that kind of beacon in the world. Yeah. And I think if you've got all three of them, then it can become a really powerful combination. So if you've got all three of them, if you've got people living and practicing in those different ways, actually they can support each other and reinforce each other, and it can become a really powerful combination. So I just want to say a little bit more about how that might work. So you could see it as a threefold model of Sangha. So there's three ways in which people are part of the Sangha, three ways in which people tend to live and practice, or three ways in which people are in the Sangha and how they interact with the world. So there's what I'm going to call retreatants, what I'm going to call social engagers, and what I'm going to call Sangha builders. So you'll see that the three correspond to the three ways that I was describing before. Yeah. So retreatants, social engagers, and Sangha builders. So the retreatants are the people who, the way they live their Dharma life, the way they work and practice, the way they contribute to the overall life and culture of the Sangha, is by removing themselves from the world. They get away from the hurly-burly of life, and they maybe live on retreat. They maybe focus on meditation and Dharma practice. Or maybe they're writers and artists who, again, just withdraw from the world so they can really deeply, intensively engage with their work. Yeah. And it's great for a spiritual community to have people living and practicing in this way. They can really contribute depth and intensity of Dharma practice. And well, we know, don't we? Some people in our community do this. They might come back from a long retreat and they come back with something really to share, real kind of depth of experience and connection to the Dharma, which they can share and which can help and inspire others. So it's great to have retreatants, as long as you just haven't just got them yet, as long as they're part of the overall culture, the overall mix of the Sangha. Secondly, there's the social engagers. I don't really like this term, but I couldn't think of a better one. So these are the people who, the main way they express their Dharma practice, the main way they live their Dharma life, and the main way they relate to the world is by going into the world, trying to respond to what they see around them, trying to use their Dharma practice to respond to suffering, to whatever they see the need is around them. So yes, we could have people working to alleviate poverty and injustice. We could have people teaching mindfulness to people who are suffering from chronic pain. Or we could have people maybe running a Buddhist-inspired restorative justice project. I mean, there are so many things. There are loads and loads of things that maybe could be done as a response to the world, getting out into the world in that kind of way. And then thirdly, there's the Sangha builders. So these are the people, the way they practice, the way they live their Dharma life, the way they relate to the world around them, is by building Sangha, by creating Sangha, by trying to create places and contexts where people can contact the Dharma, where people can really start to transform themselves, where people can practice the Dharma and live the Dharma. So they're the people who are trying to kind of create that world within the wider world, as it were. And my point is that, in a way, that one needs to come first for the reasons that I've explained. But then, yes, you also need the other two. You need a whole kind of culture, a whole kind of Sangha with people living and working and practicing in these different ways. And if you've got all of them, they can really inspire and support and, well, counterbalance each other. Yeah. So the retreatants, they can provide a sort of depth and intensity and a real focus on the Dharma in a very pure and undiluted form. Yeah. So where the other two might be getting kind of busy and kind of caught up in worldly things, they just provide a kind of clear, pure emphasis on the Dharma, as it were. The social engagers, they're out there in the world. They're reminding people of what's going on in the world. They're reminding people of the necessity to respond to the suffering world so that that doesn't get forgotten, so that people don't become a bit kind of self-absorbed or lost in their own practice, as it were. So they're providing something to the overall health and dynamic of the Sangha. And the Sangha builders, well, they're just making sure the kind of spiritual community carries on into the future, that it remains spiritually vital, and, well, they help and inspire the people that are going out into the world. They're going out, it's demanding, it kind of pulls you into the world, but you can have contact with the Sangha and you can be refreshed and inspired and supported in the work that you're doing. So in all these ways, these three ways of living and practicing can work together. They can support each other. They can be part. It's all the same project. They're all in their own ways, trying to be that bodhisattva response to the world. Yeah, they're all making their own contribution to the health of the Sangha, and therefore their own contribution to the world. And you can see these different ways of living and practicing in the life of the Buddha. If you read the life of the Buddha, he had time where he went into the forest, he left the world, he went on long retreat, but then he went back to the world and he founded an order, he founded a spiritual community so that the Dharma could really be shared with people and could be taught and could kind of grow and continue into the future. But he didn't just do that, he went into the world even further. He went and talked with kings and ministers. He went and debated with other religious leaders. He was a real voice in the society and culture of that time. So in the life and the practice of the Buddha, you do see those three ways of living and practicing. And you also see in what he set up, he was encouraging other people to live and practice in that way as well. And it's the same in our own little community. You can see the way Sangharakshita set up the Triratna Buddhist community. In a way, he's trying to do what the Buddha did. In a very different language, in a very different culture and time, he's trying to do the same thing. He founded an order, which is a kind of nucleus of people who've made a spiritual commitment and who are dedicated to working on themselves and overcoming that limited self. But they also work with others in a movement that's reaching out into the world, that's trying to be active in the world. So in a way, that's what we're trying to do. That's what the the Tree Ratna Buddhist community is about, in a way. So in a sense, we have to find our own way to contribute. We have to find our way to practice, our way of living and working in this world, our way of contributing to the kind of overall life of the Sangha and this overall project of us trying to be the Bodhisattva response to the world. And people will have different skills and different interests and different temperaments. And yes, we just have to go through a process of working out how can we use those to best use? How can I make the best contribution I can do? And probably we'll actually have an element of all three ways of living and working in our overall Dharma life. We'll have time on retreat. We'll maybe have time when we're more in the world. We'll maybe have time when we're more sort of involved in the Sangha, as it were. We probably need all three, and maybe we'll go through different phases of our Dharma life over time. But yes, basically it's about working out how can we give to the world, how can we work with others to try and do this. And in a way, that's what Tree Ratna Buddhist community is about. We're trying to be that overall Bodhisattva response to the world, helping people find their way to give to the world. Sometimes by providing actual opportunities to do that, sometimes just trying to inspire and support people to do it in the world in their own way. So last area I want to talk about before I finish is just wanted to say a bit about the special value of working together. So Buddhists working together on a common project. Because again, this is something that we've emphasised in Tree Ratna Buddhist community. The special value of working with others who share the same values and ideals as us, and we're trying to do the same thing together. So why has this been particularly emphasised? I suppose it's because it's a particularly powerful way, or it can be a particularly powerful way, of transforming self and world. In a way, if you work and live with others on a common project, you have to transform yourself. It's almost like you're forced to do it. You have to cooperate with others. You have to kind of see your habits, see your kind of unhelpful tendencies, see your limitations. And you have to try and work on those in order to be able to cooperate with others and work with others. And you have to help others to transform themselves too. Again, you have to try and be a good influence, helping each other find ways of working and cooperating together, understanding each other, being able to work together more and more effective. So in a way, working together creates a special kind of demand that can, at its best, draw you out beyond yourself, be strongly transformative in that kind of way, really kind of draw you out beyond your limitations. So hopefully you're drawing out the best in each other. Of course, what happens is, as some of you know from personal experience, before you draw out the best in each other, you sometimes have to draw out the worst in each other, and there's kind of storming and difficulty. But hopefully you can get through that, and you can really learn to understand each other, and you start bringing out the best in each other more and more fully. So there's a kind of mutual self-transcendence, self-transformation. You're really helping each other transform yourself in that kind of way. And sometimes we talk about this mutual transcendence raised to a very high degree, the whole language and teaching of the bodhicitta. So Sangharakshita has talked about the bodhicitta arising not in one person alone, but amongst a community. It might be picked up on some people more than others, but basically it arises amongst a community of people who are living and working together on a common cause. So this bodhicitta arises, but it's not theirs. It's not a personal attainment. What it is an opening up to something much bigger, aligning with a more profound motivation that's at work in the world. Bodhicitta is what happens when people really give up their self-clinging. It's what arises in its place, when self is no longer there. A different kind of volition, a different kind of energy, a different kind of passion starts to come into being. So maybe that sounds a bit idealistic, a bit distant and impossible. What does it really mean? So I'm going to tell you the story of Sangharakshita at Nagpur Many of you will know this story, but I find it a very moving, inspiring story, and I can really feel it and see it in my imagination. So as many of you will know, Dr. Ambedkar, the great leader of the ex-untouchables, converted to Buddhism, and then tragically, only 6 weeks later, he died. He suddenly died. And all his people, hundreds of thousands of people who followed him, suddenly found themselves without a leader. Sangharakshita had met Ambedkar once or twice before this, but he found himself in Nagpur, a big city in the middle of India, where there was going to be a huge gathering of mourners. And he's asked to go along and speak at that gathering. So last year I went to India, and I actually went to the place where this happened. It's a great big, vast, empty space in the middle of the city. So I can really see it in my imagination, this big space full of people, hundreds of thousands of people. And in the middle there's this rickety stage and a crackly microphone. So people go up to speak, but they just burst into tears. They're just unable to speak. They're so grief-struck. And the atmosphere is just gradually becoming more and more dejected. And then eventually it's Sangharakshita's turn. So he climbs onto the stage and he looks out at that sea of faces. And they're tear-streaked, frightened faces. And maybe he doesn't know what he's going to say. What can he say? What can he possibly say to them? They've lost their leader at such a critical time. And he, Sangharakshita, he's from such a different background to them, such different life experience. What can he possibly say to them? But he manages to get all that out the way. He knows that he simply has to say something. The situation demands it. He gets himself out the way. He gets any doubt or despair or fear out the way, and he allows something else to come in. He allows himself to be a channel for the Dharma, for the compassion of the Dharma. He tells them that Ambedkar has died, but that he can live on in their lives, their efforts to change their lives through the Dharma. And in one of his memoirs, Sign of the Golden Wheel, you can read about this incident, and it's an amazing incident. And then he talks about how profoundly moved he was by this, and how energized he was by it, and how he just found himself working with that community very, very intensely in the weeks that followed, with a kind of energy that he just didn't know where it came from. So it's an amazing story, but again, perhaps it still seems a far cry from our experience. But actually, I wonder whether many of us have had times in our lives when we've responded, when we've given ourselves to something bigger than us, when we've given ourselves to an ideal, and we catch at least a glimmer, at least a sense, at least a hint of what this bodhicitta might mean, at least a sense of what it might mean. I think I have had times in my life where I've experienced something like that myself. A few times. So, for example, many years ago, I was working with a team of people to create the Birmingham Buddhist Centre. I was working really hard. We were really engaged. We really believed in what we were doing. We were really passionate about what we were trying to do. And there was a sense, there was something in the air that we would just do whatever it took to make it happen. If we needed more money for the project, well, I thought I'd just go out and get a job and I'll earn some money and I'll give some money. It's just a kind of willingness to really kind of give oneself, to really do whatever was necessary. You just do whatever it took to make it happen. And I remember in that time and other times as well, it's a very different experience of oneself arises. It's a strange combination of confidence and humility. I felt really fired up, really confident, a real sense of we can do anything, we can do this. But at the same time, you know that you can only do it with others. You can only do it with the people that you're working with. There's no way you could do it by yourself. You're totally dependent on your friends. So there's also, as well as confidence, a sense of humility, a sense of awareness of your dependence, a sense of gratitude and connectedness. So in a way, it doesn't feel like it's you doing it. It's more a sense of being part of something bigger, something significant, something valuable. It doesn't cancel out your sense of yourself, but it refines it. It's a different kind of motivation, a different kind of volition, which is very difficult to describe in words. And it's not about being really busy and important or worked off your feet. It's more a quality of receptivity, just giving what you can, being willing to try and serve, to do what you can to help others. It might be quite quiet, you're just quietly getting on with it in the background. And you may not always feel adequate. You might not know what to say or do. But the Bodhisattva attitude is just being willing to try, being willing to change, to try to change so that you can grow, so that you can overcome limitations, so that you can more adequately respond to the situation. That's the Bodhisattva attitude. So working with others in this self-transforming, world-transforming way, that's the Bodhisattva's reply. And that's what Tree Ratna is about. It's working together to transform self and so create a better world. And in the first 20 or 30 years of Tree Ratna, we did that very strongly. The movement grew very fast. There was big vision. There was strong idealism. There was a real wish to respond to the world. It was a real motive for people. And there was, of course, also naivety, inexperience and mistakes. And you could probably say that the last 10, 15 years in our movement have been more a time of taking stock, of maturing, of consolidating, of reconsidering what it's all about. But my hope or my dream is that we are now more mature and confident and experienced. And we are therefore ready for the big vision again, ready to take the Dharma out into the world. There's still so many towns in the UK where there's no Sangha. There's so many major cities in Europe where there's no Dharma available, not to mention the rest of the world. There's so many people who would love to hear the freedom teachings of the Dharma and to encounter real live spiritual community. So that's my hope, that we can really get out there and do that more and more as the years go by, create spiritual communities and therefore create a kind of basis from which people can also go out working in the world. So I hope, yes, we can kind of continue working together, giving voice, giving active expression to the Bodhisattva's reply. Together, collectively, being a voice for the Bodhisattva, a fearless voice of wisdom and compassion.